Welcome to Synapse's Brain Bank podcast, a place for people and families impacted by brain injury to share their stories and connect with specialists from the field. Join our host, Dr. Zara Whedon, as we hear from everyday Australians and tap into advice and resources to help you on your brain injury path.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Tess Hallett, a speech pathologist. Hello. Could you tell us a bit about yourself, Tess?
Hey, Zara. Yeah, absolutely. So I am a speech pathologist. I work quite specifically in brain injury, in acquired brain injury. It's an area that I love to help within. So I worked for a private practice in Brizzy for about 4 years, and now I've gone out on my own. I'm based on the Gold Coast and those surrounding areas. I basically stumbled into the area of working in brain injury because it is quite specific and quite niche, and I absolutely love it. I love everything about it, and I love being able to help people who have had a brain injury and their families as well. So that's where I am today.
That sounds like a pretty good place to be, certainly from my point of view. So Tess, from a speech pathology perspective, how does brain injury actually show up?
It's tricky because I think you would know that even if someone has almost the exact same injury, that can manifest really differently for different people. But it also depends whether someone has had, say, you know, like yourself, what people class as a traumatic brain injury, whether it's in contact or there's an accident, versus someone who may have had a stroke or an aneurysm or another bleed, something to that effect. And it also depends, I suppose, where that trauma has occurred in the brain. I will say that a lot of people who would say have a stroke, generally speaking, this is the problem. There's too much now to talk about, I suppose. But in terms of my world, communication obviously is at its core. So for some people, that the communication difficulties can present with talking too much. Maybe talking.
I'm smiling because that was me before and me more now.
But yeah, you're right, talking too much, maybe going off on tangents, maybe using words the way
no
they
filter,
go around.
No filter at all.
Yeah, no filter. That is absolutely so normal, really heightened emotion. Yeah. So I think for a lot of people who I've worked with, They do the exact same thing, Zara. They smile and go, oh, it's almost a relief because they're not alone. They know they're not alone. And I think that can be quite hard for them afterwards because from what they've told me, they have an injury. They may go through hospital, they get services there, but then it's like, where do I go from here? Am I eligible for NDIS funding? Great, but what does that even mean? Like, where do I go? Am I eligible for maybe another funding body if I got injured in New South Wales or Victoria but I live in Queensland? Or is it a motor vehicle accident? But it's just, there's so much to navigate, and I think that in and of itself is so overwhelming. So yeah, they have the same reaction if I say, oh, you know, maybe you have difficulty thinking of the words that you want. They're like, I do, I really do. And that's another one, thinking of words. You know, it's quite tricky. Some people might have even difficulties understanding and even organising and processing information that they hear, that they read, social communication, interpreting what other people are saying. I don't want it to sound like there could be a wealth of things that could go wrong, but I guess it's nice that there are lots of areas that I see that I can help with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense. And I think I've got a vague memory in my mind that the different, lots of different areas of where your speech can be different to how it was before.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that must be a really hard thing to have this, I guess, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, Zara, because I haven't lived the experience, but have an identity that you know you have had pre-accident and maybe coming to terms moving through
it. Yeah, I think that happened for me a bit, but for some reason I was actually not that unhappy. With a change in life? Yeah. I still live in the same place. No, there's good things. So, Tessa, we've talked about talking too much or going off on tangents. Could you give me some examples of the strategies you would suggest?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question, Zara. So a lot of times with things like maybe going off on tangents or talking too much, adopting a bit more of that, I guess, what we would call a meta approach, walking through and talking about exactly what is going on is probably the most effective. So, for example, actually saying, okay, great, why don't we maybe have a phrase or a signal or something that we can start to practice that I as your teacher can use to flag to you that maybe you're going off on a tangent and you need to come back, or maybe that we just need to be a bit more concise, and then we can start to use that with your people who are around, your family and friends. And that will depend on the person themselves, because one of the things that can be impacted if someone has a brain injury is their level of insight and ability to actually realise that those things are a bit difficult for them. And insight can be really, really tricky to teach, you know. So that in and of itself can also be a really big process. But definitely, yeah, definitely trying to incorporate those strategies into everyday life. That is the biggest and most important thing. So if we're talking about, oh, how was your day? Having that signpost or that flagging of maybe you're going off topic, having that embedded in those types of conversations. And that's why the more you can get family and friends and communication partners, is what we like to say, involved, amazing, the better and more functional it could be.
Yeah, that's good to know.
I was just wondering, Zara, if that was something that a speechy did with you, or if you remember a speechy did something like that or something different.
The vague recollection I have is that they were making me read things. My vision's very bad. It was actually really hard, and I'm not completely sure why they made me do it, because my vision's not getting better from doing that. But made me listen to a story on Catalyst and then write what my answers were to the questions. That was probably my brain, my memory or retention. So I don't know if they worked out my tangential thinking or speech. Or talking a lot. They may have worked that out, but I don't remember them. I guess I saw them every day for 3 months, and they were probably going to, I think, more function of capability to remember things. And I'm not completely sure what they were thinking, but it was less torture than occupational therapy.
I hope it was like a most impact for you approach, like biggest impact and then, yeah, following on from there, I would assume.
Yeah, I think so. My husband says I don't remember how I was when I first got to rehab, not completely, or maybe I have different recollections to my husband. I said, I don't remember not saying the right words or not saying words correctly. I said, when I got to rehab, I think I was speaking fine. He said, 50% of the time you made sense. I'm like, what? I thought I always made sense, but that was probably not much awareness at that point, which I think I had a bit later, like when I was coming out of rehab. But, yeah, so I think my function of speech wasn't normal at the beginning. I was also intubated for quite a while. That probably didn't help. But I guess it's a function of getting the words spoken properly.
Yeah, well, Well, that reduced awareness is totally normal as well initially. A lot of people say to me they don't remember so much of those first days.
Yeah, absolutely. Another question that's occurred to me, Tess, is do you think people are too accepting of their new normal when actually there is help available for them?
Yeah, amazing question. Yeah. I do think that. I think a lot of people initially are in survival mode, in that they're trying to come to terms with, oh my gosh, is this how I think now? Is this how I understand the world? Is this how I move now? You know, they're trying to reconcile this whole new potential identity that they're coming to terms with. And that's the thing, I think, that because they're reconciling that, that they're not, a lot of people can take quite some time to be what I suppose what is called therapy ready. And I really, really, really strongly try to advocate for people to get into therapy as soon as they're ready, because you would know with your medical background, Zara, that there gains can be made for people across their lifespan, but the biggest change that we will affect after a brain injury is in that two-ish year mark.
I remember, don't drink alcohol until 2 years after your brain injury. Don't have children until, I think they said don't have children. I can't remember. They may not have, and I may have some false memory. I think it was a good idea, though, you know, when you learn. Anyway, again, I've got to not go off, go on these tangents. But we've actually talked to a nurse unimanager in episode 4, season 1, and I do recall her saying that 2 years is not where it ends. There's still room for improvement later.
Absolutely. So they, I guess that 2 year period is talking about neuroplasticity and the brain's ability to make those big changes while it's in that healing period, which, you know, it's a balance because you want to advocate for people to really get in and attack therapy basically, but they might need some time to come to terms with just surviving before they're ready. So I try to have those conversations with people when I get referrals to see people, and if they're not ready, I'm there to chat to and check in with them and consult with them until they're ready. And I try to give them much information in, you know, a way that's hopefully not going to overwhelm them about how it can be helpful for them. But you're absolutely right what you said about that 2 year period. Yeah, great, let's smash it in that 2 year period. But I still see people who are 10, 20 years beyond, and while we're not going to make those big brain changes that we're hoping for, we're still going to make some improvements if we're committed to achieving goals. You know, that's the whole point. So I'm a big advocate of, we don't just need to operate within that 2 year time frame for sure.
Tess, from a medical perspective, I used to think of a speech pathologist's role as assessing swallowing. And as a parent, I've thought of speech pathologist's role as of improving their speech. But obviously there's so much more to it. Could you give us some examples of the different activities that some people may have done during rehab?
Yeah. Swallowing is definitely a really key part initially, you're right, Zara, where people are in hospital. So safety, I guess, above everything else. So a speechie will come in and check that their eating and drinking is safe so that they're not getting food or liquid into their lungs and getting aspiration or aspiration pneumonia. And then speech sounds for kiddos, super common as well. So that's a really big area. We're really lucky as speechies in that we have a really massive practice area that we can choose. Yeah, massive areas between. So, for example, someone can specialise in stuttering, which is probably another really big area that people know speeches for. But then, say, if you're working with people who are more in the area I work in with brain injury, someone might have a stroke and they may be diagnosed with something called aphasia, which is probably one of the more common diagnoses after stroke. So people might have difficulties with their language. So really big difference there. I try to highlight quite a lot. People feel like their intelligence is lesser after they have a brain injury or a stroke. And it's language purely in that it's affecting people's ability to potentially read and write, understand language and express it, whether that's verbally or written. Another person, you know, might have something coexisting with that called apraxia of speech or dysarthria, which are both motor speech disorders, which is to do with the way the brain communicates getting actual sounds out. So that could be weakness, which is more associated with dysarthria, or actually literally using the structures and the bits in your mouth, like your tongue and your teeth, lips, to make the sounds, which is more that apraxia side. And then there's a whole other world of things called cognitive communication, which is more high level. Someone might have difficulties with memory, with problem solving and reasoning things. And another big one, which occupational therapists also help a lot with, is attention, which is literally focusing, being able to focus on something, which, you know, then affects how you remember things. And it just, it all ties in so closely together. So, and that is just in the area of brain injury. And that's not even touching on, you know, the social side of communication, and which we also work a lot with, because that can be quite challenging for people after a brain injury too. So, you know, one day I could be working with someone on understanding tone of voice from someone that they're speaking to, and understanding sarcasm, and maybe reading between the lines so they can communicate a bit more. And then that same afternoon, I might work with someone on, okay, let's go to Kmart and pick out products that you really want to purchase and think of the names for them, but then also read the tags and associate those things with one another. So there's just so much breadth and depth for what you would do with people, and it's so dependent on their goals and what is going to make the biggest difference to their lives. So communication is the big overarching title, I suppose, but then there's so many things underneath that I work with people on. So yeah, massive.
Yeah. When people are having difficulties with their communication or comprehension, where do you think they first start to find help?
Yeah, great question. A lot of people can and do start by checking in with their GP and saying, hey, I'm experiencing this, or I'm having trouble with this. Can you recommend? I, unfortunately, in my personal experience, have found that there isn't as much education in the GP community about what we do. Having a bit of a Google can be really helpful, but can also lead you down some rabbit holes, I'm sure many people know. But having a Google of even speech pathology, NDIS-specific things in your area, just as a place to start, even if you just harass someone, give them a call and say, hey, this is what's going on. Can you help me, or can someone else help me? There's Facebook groups, and support groups are also really, really brilliant. So if there's brain injury-specific ones, there's one called Genius Network, which is G-E-N-Y-U-S, and that's founded by a young gentleman who had a stroke himself, and his organisation is absolutely brilliant, burgeoning and so supportive. The Stroke Network, if you've had a stroke, sorry, the stroke organisation rather, Australia, Stroke Australia, Speech Pathology Australia, but if you do Google Speech Pathology Australia, it means that you know that you need a speechy, which often is the hardest part, right? So that's why a lot of people go to their GP initially, because that's their medical person. So, I mean, even if you have other allied health people in your life, like a physio or an occupational therapist, it's worth touching base with them, because they can say, oh, that sounds like you might need maybe a speechy, or maybe a neuropsychologist or someone like that. But it's really hard, because if you're just thinking, oh, I've got these things going on, you're not necessarily going to think, I need a speech pathologist.
Yeah, I think the term is one that not everyone knows, speech pathologist.
That can be quite tricky. A lesser area that is up and coming, that a lot of people aren't aware that is actually available, is like a lot of actual technology and whatnot that's available as well. So there's some of them cost, but there's brilliant apps that are available for people with a brain injury as well, that are really having a lot of difficulty expressing themselves. There are all these wonderful technologies called AAC, which is alternative and augmentative communication. So that could be anything from like an iPad, for example, that you touch, and it has typing to talking mechanism, which is brilliant, through to eye gaze technology, which is, I suppose, the most commonly publicized version would be something like you picture Stephen Hawking's type of communication system. But there's all these brilliant new devices now where even if someone doesn't have the capacity to touch a screen or use a joystick, they can use their eye to select things to communicate from a screen. And it's wonderful, and it just keeps getting better and better. And I don't think that's as well known, because I think people, family members might think, oh no, she can't talk and she's maybe in her wheelchair, we're on our own, like what can we do? But there is potentially stuff out there, which is really, really exciting. And it's like, yes, yeah, having that contact with people in allied health, they're going to potentially be like, oh, well, I might put you in touch with this person. So it's tricky finding that first step. But, yeah, it's out there and there might be something appropriate, you know.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Tess. Could we finish up with some tips for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. No matter what's going on, I think a couple of things are potentially going to be helpful for people with brain injury and for their communication people around them. The first one, if you can, is making sure that you're facing the person you're communicating with and making sure they can see you. Going slow, if you can, like just slowing your rate down a little bit can be really beneficial if someone's having trouble understanding. Breaking large bits of information into steps can be really great. If you can support that as well with gestures or writing down keywords, even better, fantastic. And in everyday life, if you guys want to have a one-to-one conversation, reducing background noise can be really helpful too, like a TV, for example, or if a radio's on, or if you're in a shopping centre, just going somewhere a bit quieter can be really helpful just for that communication. So they're super general tips, but often they can make a really big impact for someone's communication when they have a brain injury.
I think they are really good tips.
The only other thing I want to do is make sure that people aren't afraid to ask questions if they have them. So if they're not sure, go to your GP. If you're not sure about what your GP has said, have a big Google. Like, you know, if you think something is wrong, I know it can be really hard and a bit scary, but like advocate for yourself, because speaking purely for myself, I'm here, I want to help in any way that I can. And I think that, you know, other speakers really want to do the same. So, yeah.
Thank you so much, Tess. It's been lovely talking to you.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you, Zara.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Brain Bank podcast, brought to you by Synapse, Australia's peak body for brain injury. Make sure you visit our website, synapse.org.au, where you'll find useful resources and tools to connect you to our brain injury community. And while you're there, please complete the podcast survey. We want to know what you've enjoyed, what's worked for you, and what you think we should cover in the next series. At Synapse, we're creating change for people from all walks of life who have been impacted by brain injury. Remember to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode.